Spine tingling greetings, everybody. Thank you so much for stopping by and making Paranormal Prowlers podcast part of your day. Those tunes you are hearing are courtesy of the lovely Bobby Mackey, and I, of course, am your host, Tessa Morrow.
Day at a different place, all the same with a new face, with strange mysteries hanging in the air. People in their sane minds swear they see you today.
Okay, everybody, in just a couple of short days is the 5-year anniversary of Paranormal Prowlers podcast. First time hearing it on April 10th, 2019. So, woohoo! Thank you, everybody. Super appreciate y'all listening. Now, we have 100 and counting countries who have listened to the podcast. And again, I'm just so appreciative, ever so grateful. This week's special city shoutouts take us to Hagersville, Canada, Honolulu, Hawaii, Castro Valley, California, Ellesmere Port, England, Saskatoon, Canada, and Hyattsville, Maryland. You guys and gals are all tremendously awesome in my book. This week we find ourselves at the old Idaho State Penitentiary, located in Boise. This has been featured on several different paranormal shows, and it's just a stone's throw away from Boise's downtown. Standing tall on 510 acres, the penitentiary opens its doors in 1872, and it will close them down 101 years later in 1973. And during that 101 years, over 13,000 dangerous souls would come through here and call this place their home. The territory of Idaho was only 7 years old when the penitentiary was constructed, and 20 years later before Idaho would even become a state. Now, in 1869, by act of Congress, 1 mile east of Boise, land is designated to be the territorial prison land, and a sandstone quarry was conveniently close by, which would be used while they built. Part of the construction, as we see in many of these, was conducted by none other than the inmates themselves. The layout and design itself actually comes from an inmate named George Hamilton, who was a skilled architect, if you will, when he was not busy being a highwayman, which I found to be pretty interesting. In 1870, construction breaks ground, and it is completed in January the following year. At this time, 42 cells are installed. And a couple years later, in 1872, the very first prisoners are sent here, all 11 of them. No overcrowding here, huh? In 1885, they welcome who would become the youngest inmate to walk through their doors, 10-year-old James Oscar Baker. 10 years old. I don't know about you, but when I was 10, I was playing with my friends, bowling, mini golf, hiking, checking out mica mines, riding horses. That was my life. What did this 10-year-old soul do where he was sent to a penitentiary? Apparently, it was a case of self-defense while at a saloon that his father was employed at. It was called Soda Spring Saloon. A drunk just begins throwing threats back and forth, yelling at his father and what have you. I don't know if things were getting physical, but he felt the need that he had to defend himself and especially his father, and he shoots and kills the man. The fact that this poor young boy was put in that situation and felt that he had to do something like that is completely heartbreaking. He is pardoned, and he serves less than a year for manslaughter. In 1887, the old Idaho State Penitentiary welcomes the very first female inmate. In 1889, a second cell house is built here, and they add an additional 42 cells. The following year, in 1890, Idaho will become the 43rd state, and the once territorial prison now becomes a state prison. By the time 1920 comes around, a new women's ward is built, and it can house 14 inmates. They keep adding things on. Added in 1923 is a solitary confinement structure, and in 1950, the fifth cell house is built and is able to house 320 inmates, which helps a hell of a lot with overcrowding issues that we see in almost every single one of these types of things. The prisons, the asylums, penitentiaries, the jails. You know what I mean. You know. Old Idaho State Penitentiary. Home to suicides, murders, executions, riots, and escapes. In fact, when it comes to the latter, over 500 escape attempts have taken place here, and at least a whopping 90 of them are successful. Ouch. Very ouch. Not only was this penitentiary home to dangerous men and women, but a feline also called the pen home. In 1952, on one fateful day, an inmate, he comes upon a tiny, ever so tiny and precious kitten in the prison's barn. Now, while the prison obviously did not allow the inmates to have any type of pet, for some reason this little kitten won their hearts and they allowed this tiny little furball to stick around and adopted him. The inmates, they love him, they care for him, they lovingly name him Dennis. And he lived his entire life here at the prison. He's showered with love, affection, and attention by the inmates, some who are obviously hardened criminals, some whose crimes are incredibly heinous. And guess what, you guys? Dennis would live here at the state pen for 16, 17 years. Some, if not all, may think that a prison is no place for a cat, right? But he was quite content living here. He was happy. Fast forward to 1968, and Dennis the cat, loved by many a guard and inmate, and which was a very warm, welcome addition to the prison, bringing happiness in such a sad and dreadful place, dies peacefully in his sleep. Now, obviously, when this happens, everybody's completely heartbroken. I mean, this cat was a daily fixture in their lives for 16 years. These inmates, I mean, this cat was literally their life when they were inside. It was like really the only positive thing they had. So his furry presence was hugely missed when he was gone. To them, it was like losing a family member. And that's exactly what Dennis was. He was a furry family member to these people. A funeral for Dennis the cat is conducted and a headstone is made for him. Dennis is the only one buried within the prison walls. Now, I found this on history.idaho.gov that they have an annual Dennis the Cat Day. And I want to read this to you. This is a little bit that I found because this happens every year now. And I think it would be fun to check out sometime, especially for my Idaho folks or people planning to be visiting Idaho sometime. So here we go. Quote, "Join the old Idaho Penitentiary on a summer Sunday afternoon and discover the story of the penitentiary historic animal mascot, Dennis the Cat, during our second annual Dennis the Cat Day. Activities include prison pets history presentations, prison paws scavenger hunt, and more. Food trucks, beer, and alcohol. Local pet supply vendors, special presentations, new Dennis merchandise, and more will be available. Be sure to bring donations of unopened pet food for admission to the prison pets history presentations. Donations benefit the Idaho Humane Society and Simply Cats, Boise's cageless, no-kill feline adoption center. Between 1950 to 1968, Dennis lived among the staff and residents of the Idaho State Penitentiary. Upon Dennis's death in 1968, the prison population buried him nearby within the main yard, fashioning a durable, engraved headstone, marking his resting place during his funeral services. Today, guests of the old Idaho Penitentiary regularly pay their respects at his stone, the only marked grave within the prison walls," unquote. That's really cool. That's neat that they have this Dennis the Cat Day, and it helps benefit animals in the area as well, and local businesses. So I really like that. That's really neat. Bringing people together to help out, keeping Dennis the Cat's memory oh so alive. Like many institutions like this, The old Idaho State Pen, well, it was well equipped. Many additional services include a commissary, a hospital, a gymnasium, a shoe shop, the chapel, a library, a shirt factory and a license plate shop, a bakery, a hobby room, and much more. In addition to this, they also have their very own heating, lighting, and pumping plant. Very convenient, as it provided them with their very own water, heat, and electricity. Woohoo! In 1973, the penitentiary is added on the National Register of Historic Places due to its time as the territorial prison, so that's pretty damn cool. The penitentiary has seen some riots take place, as we see in so many other places like this. Your jails, prison, penitentiaries, what have you. On May 24th of 1952, they see their very first riot, when the guards go against their word and put four ringleaders into solitary confinement for infraction of the rules. This doesn't sit well with inmates, and a riot begins. It would last 5 hours, and would finally end due to tear gas being introduced to the party. Uninvited guest and a stinky one at that. P.U. The second riot would take place on August the 8th of 1971, so we have a nice chunk of time that had gone by between the first and the second riot. Almost 20 years, actually. A building that was once the barber shop, turned hospital, turned social services office, is burned to the ground during this riot. $25,000 in damages have taken place, and today, in 2024, that's the same in value as $193,148. Two inmates, they're badly injured as the result of being shivved. Well, another inmate, he's brutally murdered. And some accounts say that he was brutally raped before being murdered, right by the showers. Lewiston Morning Tribune reports on the riot, August 9th, 1971, titled, Buildings Burned at Idaho Prison. And it reads this, quote, Inmates of the Idaho State Prison rioted Tuesday night, setting fires which destroyed two buildings in the ancient prison complex. At least two prisoners were stabbed and taken to a hospital. The number of inmates involved in the riot was not known immediately. The riot apparently was the result of the discovery of an escape tunnel, prison officials said. William Evans, associate prison superintendent in charge of operations, said the tunnel was discovered by prison officials Sunday, and word apparently spread among inmates. One building destroyed housed the social services center, and the other was a reception area. Prisoners began tearing up the recreation center, Evans said, and guards fired two shots of tear gas into the group. Director of Correction, Raymond W. May, went into the yard after the force were extinguished and talked with leaders of the prisoners in an effort to end the rioting. Unquote. The last known final riot happens not too long after the second one, starting March 7th and ending on the 8th, in 1973. A chapel that had been around since the 1930s, well, it's completely and utterly destroyed by fire. The 1898 dining hall also burns to the ground. The north wing cell house, too, burns as well. So we're seeing a ton of damage here. Fast forward, months later, December 3rd, 1973, remaining inmates are transferred to another location in southern Idaho. And this establishment closes its doors for the very last time. She has seen and experienced her last riot. Some of the inmates to call the old Idaho State Penitentiary home includes Hennepy, who was a Blackfoot Indian, and she was here for manslaughter. Harry Orchard, he serves a 46-year sentence as he was successful in the assassination of former Governor Frank Stuenberg. Frank was the fourth governor of Idaho, serving from 1897 to 1901. He is killed right outside of his home by a bomb. His murder investigation was conducted by the Pinkerton Agency. The former governor? Well, he's believed to haunt the penitentiary to this very day. Now, his killer? Harry Orchard? He confessed to killing a number of people. 17 to be exact. And if this is accurate, it makes him a full-blown serial killer. The old Idaho State Penitentiary was once home to Idaho's Lady Bluebeard, Lyda Southard. She was a serial killer who took extreme pleasure in snuffing the life out of her own family. She is suspected of murdering at least 4 husbands, and this black widow, in addition to the men she promised to love and honor forever, also kills her own daughter, at least one, and a brother-in-law as well. Greed was in her soul. Money bags were in her eyes. She did this for life insurance payouts. To this day, this is still a motive for people offing their family members. It's just so horrible. Apparently, you can put a price on a life. Her accomplice is arsenic. In 1915, Lyda and her first husband, Robert, their beloved little girl, who, mind you, is not even 2 years old, she dies suddenly. And obviously, this is very unexpected, at least to the people who aren't expecting it. Lyda would go on to say that Lorraine drank bad water from a dirty well, and that's how she died. Okay, that's believable, right? That wouldn't be the first time somebody had drank bad water and died because of it, and it certainly wouldn't be the last. That very year, Robert's brother and Lyda's brother-in-law, he dies. He was a young, healthy man, so this, just like the 2-year-old daughter, this death is very suspicious. It's unexpected. Cause of death is ptomaine poisoning, better known as food poisoning. And months later, same year, mind you, we already have 2 deaths, her husband dies. Cause of death, typhoid fever. Now some may think, oh my God, this poor woman. Oh. In 1 year, she had to say goodbye and bury her daughter, her brother-in-law, and now her husband. How gut-wrenching, how heartbreaking, how excruciating. This would cripple anyone. Anyone, right? Anyone that's innocent, at least. Lyda, she seemed to be okay, though. In fact, she was thriving, quite financially. For every single one of these deaths, 3 in 1 year, she was making a decent amount of money. 2 years after the triple deaths of her family, making her the sole survivor, by the way, she marries husband number 2. Not too long into the marriage, tragedy strikes when a baby, unsure if this is the husband's baby with another woman, or if this is a second child of hers, but this baby becomes terribly ill and dies. The following year, her husband, William McCaffell, he dies too. Cause of death is influenza and diphtheria. The following year, in 1919, she marries Harlan Lewis. Marriage number 3 lasts only a few short months, cut short due to him, no shocker here, dying. He becomes extremely ill. They say it was complications of gastroenteritis. In mid-1920, she's married for the 4th time to Edward Meyer. It seems like every new marriage is shorter than the last. For the very next month, the new groom is dead, believed to be from typhoid fever. Men are dropping dead like flies when it comes to this serial killer black widow broad. Now, this is the part that I like. Ah, justice. Smells good. You see, the Idaho Lady Bluebeard's first husband, Robert Dooley, he had a relative who was a chemist. And something about the deaths of his family never felt right. Losing 3 family members in such a short time from bad water from a well, food poisoning, typhoid fever. Now, yes, people have died from these causes, obviously, but something was very wrong here. Something was digging in this man's gut, saying something wasn't right. That these 3 young, healthy people died so unexpectedly, so close together. His suspicions are confirmed when he found out that several other people connected to this woman also die in mysterious ways. And again, in a very close amount of time. He conducts his own investigation and does some experiments and research, and he comes to the haunting realization that this was not from drinking bad water, ptomaine poisoning, or typhoid fever. or what other laundry list of cause of deaths they came up with concerning the other victims. This, my friends, was arsenic poisoning. This was cold-blooded murder. 3 out of 4 of the husbands and 1 out of 2 of the children and the brother-in-law are all exhumed. And arsenic is found in every single freaking body. She had made thousands of dollars when it came to these life insurance policies. That's a gigantic motive, my friends. By the time they realized that these were not just accidents and realized that, okay, this woman's a serial killer, she has moved on and she was now living in Honolulu, Hawaii, and into her 5th marriage to a Navy officer named Paul Southard. With her last husband not even lasting a whole 2 months, officials knew that time was crucial. Paul, he was in grave danger. She is arrested, thankfully, and Paul's life is spared. She demands that she is innocent, but she is found guilty in the poison murders and is sentenced to what I think is a slap on the wrist. 10 years for how many murders? So what is this? 4 husbands, 2 children, 1 brother-in-law. That equals 7 known victims. God knows how many others there are. That's not even 2 years per person. That is rather an insulting sentence and punishment, if you want to even call it a punishment. Idaho's Lady Bluebeard manages to escape the old Idaho State Penitentiary. Remember all those escapes I mentioned earlier? Well, she was one of them. She makes her way to Denver, Colorado, where she marries for the 6th time. And just like Paul, her 6th husband, Harry Whitlock, he's in grave danger, with an ever-so-deadly predator lurking right under his nose. It will be this man, her 6th husband, Harry, who will eventually help authorities bring her down. She is arrested again sometime in the end of July of 1932. She does her time at the state pen when, sadly, I hate to report this, she is released in October of 1941. She's eventually pardoned, which I think is complete and utter bullshit. And again, just so insulting to the victims. I wonder how many others fell victim to this vicious monster. Sadly, this serial killer dies a free woman. I've seen plenty of people executed for a hell of a lot less. A hell of a lot. The old Idaho State Penitentiary has 10 executions under its belt. A rather small number, considering some of hundreds or thousands. Cell House 5 was home to the most dangerous criminals and the ones who just couldn't help but wreak havoc. Hello, solitary confinement. Also holding the death rowers and had a built-in gallows, which I believe only one person would be executed here at this specific location at the pen, and that one execution was botched. On site is a gorgeous rose garden, and this is the actual site where the other executions were conducted. All by hanging. November 30th of 1901, Ed Rice is the first execution. The previous October, he had murdered a cigar shop owner, stabbing him to death. He had left behind a handkerchief covered with blood right next to his victim's body. Ed Rice would become the very first man to be legally hanged at a state penitentiary. On December 16th of 1904, James Connors is executed. He had been a worker for the railroad near Blackfoot, and one night he was drinking in a Blackfoot bar. He was getting rather aggressive as more liquor enters his bloodstream, and he begins to threaten Japanese railroad workers who were frequenting the bar and who had happened to live right near that area. He was getting more agitated and angry by the second, and soon he grabs his pistol and walks towards the home where the men were living, and he begins wildly shooting. A deputy sheriff tries to apprehend Connors, but the drunk is way too quick and shoots the lawman right in the head, killing him instantly. A section foreman with the railroad tries to have the murderer surrender, hoping there would be a little bit of trust there since they knew each other. But no such luck. The foreman is shot 3 times and is badly beaten by James until he's unconscious. It didn't matter who you were. He seemed to not be able to get along with anyone. Very aggressive man. very negative individual. At his trial, he's disrespectful to the judge. While in prison, he constantly is fighting with guards. After the death walk, he is offered whiskey, something that he was very much in love with his whole life, it seemed. And, surprisingly, he declines. His last words, he's blaming the whiskey. Quote, "I was a pretty good fellow when I was sober. Whiskey brought me where I am, and I don't want any more of it." Unquote. William Henry Hicks Bond is executed August 10th of 1906. He murdered his girlfriend's husband, and it was definitely overkill as he shoots him 4 times and turns the hatchet on him several times as well. He had a partner in crime, his girlfriend, the victim's very own wife, and she actually came close to dancing with the executioner herself. And if that were the reality, she would have went down in Idaho's history as becoming the first woman to be executed. But instead, unfortunately, she got off easy and was found guilty of manslaughter. Complete bullshit. On May 7th of 1909, Fred Seward is executed. He had met a prostitute and he ends up becoming rather infatuated with her. Maybe obsessed is a better, more appropriate word. He asks her to marry him, and she rejects him. He sees red. He does not handle this well in the slightest, and the end result, he ends up murdering her. It's almost like he goes into this frenzy, and once the murderous act is complete, he looks at the scene upon him and cannot believe what he just did, and he is immediately riddled with disappointment in himself, resentment, and remorse. He just murdered the woman that he loved. He cannot live with himself, and he does attempt suicide by shooting himself. He survives this, obviously. He is injured and blinded in one eye, but he lives to see the gallows. On April 13th of 1951, Idaho sees its first and only double execution. Enter Troy Powell and Ernie Walrath. These men, they breathe their last breath on Friday the 13th. Besides being the only double execution, they also go in history as being the youngest to ever be executed in Idaho, that being 20 and 21 years old. They teamed up and beat a grocer until he was unconscious, then continued to use a butcher knife to mutilate this poor man. They then went off to drink beer with their girlfriends as if it were just a regular day for them, as if they did not just brutally murder a man. Despicable. In October of 1957, Raymond Allen Snowden, inmate number 9509, better known as Idaho's Jack the Ripper, is put to death. Snowden took pleasure in threatening women. I mean, even his very own wife was not safe. He threatens her with a knife. He attacks her. And he does spend one day, one insulting single day, in jail. And with such a little light tap on the wrist, let's just say the lesson was definitely not learned. He is given the death sentence due to the murder of Cora Lucille Dean. She had moved from Pasadena, California to Idaho 4 months prior to her murder. She was a young woman who had 2 children, and those kids were everything to her. She just adored the hell out of them. They would never ever experience her as a mother in their lives as they got older, as she was sadly taken away by a monster who thought it was okay to stab her 30 times. Some of us would say this is a little bit overkill, and it is. Now, Snowden shared that they had spent time together one mid-September evening in 1956. And yes, alcohol, it was definitely involved. He was trying to loosen her up so he could have his way with her. This left her feeling rather disgusted, and she rejects him. Because of this rejection, he admits to striking her. And her reaction is to defend herself, anybody would, and to get away from him and this results in her kicking him. This enrages Snowden to no other, and he grabs his pocket knife and he begins wildly stabbing the poor mother of two. Her body would be discovered the following day by a paperboy. After the murder, Snowden goes to Boise, where he ditches the murder weapon, the pocket knife, right down the gutter drain in front of a cigar shop, Hannafin's Cigar Shop, which, by the way, remains open to this very day. The murderer then enters the cigar shop, believed to wash his hands free from his victim's blood. 15 years before Dean's murder, he was the prime suspect of a Lynn, Massachusetts death, that of Francis Cochran's murder. But he was ultimately cleared from that. His last meal? Lobster. And considering that he was literally on death's door, he was in rather good spirits. His last words were, quote, "I cannot put into words what I want to say," unquote. Before he's executed, he would confess to murdering at least two other women, besides his known victim, Cora Dean. The statement was never proven. This wouldn't be the first time somebody who is about to be executed confesses to something else. Was he simply saying this to maybe get a stay of execution? Or was he being honest and there's two other women, two other victims, that are unknown to the authorities? If the statement is indeed true, then the state of Idaho executed a serial killer. The length of rope used for his noose is inaccurate, his neck does not break, and he slowly is strangled to death, taking close to 20 minutes for him to perish. And another snafu, besides the rope, the trap door opened rather aggressively that it caused the glass that was in the observation booth, where the victim's family, mind you, were sitting, causing it to shatter, showering the poor girl's mourning family with glass shards. It's like a scene right out of a movie or something. Shouldn't it be in reality? That's just wild. Snowden's family, they refused to claim the body, and who could blame them? He was a monster. He is ultimately buried in an unmarked grave at the prison cemetery. There is a sign that's displayed at his jail cell, and it reads this: Raymond Snowden Cell. While imprisoned, Snowden wrote letters to his family in Massachusetts. He filled his days with crossword puzzles and occasionally visited with a penitentiary chaplain. He was executed October 18, 1957, unquote. He would be the final person to be executed by hanging in Idaho. After being reinstated, they changed to lethal injection. Snowden is executed in 1957. Idaho would not see another execution until 37 years later, when murderer Keith Wells is sent to his death via lethal injection at the Idaho Maximum Security Institution. Today, there are 7 men and 1 woman on Idaho's death row. Jonathan Daniel Renfro for the shooting death of a police officer. Azad Abdullah for the murder of his wife. Timothy Dunlop for the murder of a woman during a bank robbery gone wrong. James Hairston for killing 2 people. Gerald Paisuto for beating 2 people to death. Eric Hall for raping and murdering 2 women, one in 2000, the other in 2003. Robin Rowe, the only female, for the arson murders of her husband and 2 children, a son and daughter. Then we have the serial killer of the bunch, Thomas Eugene Creech. 5 confirmed murders under his belt. But the body count was believed to be much higher, as he himself admitted to killing 43 people spanning in several different states. And there is actually an update when it comes to this man, this serial killer. In January of 2024, yeah folks, just a few weeks ago, a cold case in California is solved when they find out that he murdered a man named Daniel Walker. Today, he is the longest-serving death row inmate in the state of Idaho. Sadly, he does survive an execution attempt just a few weeks earlier, February 23rd of 2024. So, he is still a living, breathing man to this very day. Besides the 10 executions, 110 inmates have died here at the old state penitentiary. Cause of deaths include murder, suicide, and natural causes. One man who was a triple murderer, Douglas Van Vlack, he beats the executioner when he jumps to his death. Cell Block House 2 has seen at least 3 confirmed suicides, and Cell Block House 4 has 1 confirmed suicide. Now, Cell House 5 is quite active when it comes to the paranormal and supernatural. Many believe it to be the most haunted area within the penitentiary. While in the area, many people will feel anxious and rather overwhelmed with the feeling of just pure, absolute dread. So it's definitely a negative presence, it seems, that has taken over that area. I mean, this is where the botched execution of Idaho's Jack the Ripper, Raymond Snowden, took place. Remember, this is where solitary confinement was, and some of the most dangerous people that were in the prison spent a lot of time here. So of course there's going to be this negative energy just kind of lurking and lingering about. Also experienced here, what some call the Siberian cell house, are cold spots and sightings of apparitions. Raymond Snowden, who, again, was slowly strangled to death during his botched execution, well, he's believed to haunt this area where he drew his last desperate breath. Both employees and visitors have heard disembodied footsteps. Some, they've been touched. Others, even pushed. And some people have heard disembodied voices. I'd be interested to hear what type of EVPs have been captured here. Cell House Block 2 is the site of where people experience hauntings believed to be from those who had killed themselves there. And oh, the Rose Garden, where all the executions, with the exception of Snowden, were conducted. People have seen full-bodied apparition of a man in inmate garb wandering through the area. And when people see him, they think he's a real actual person. It's not like he's like translucent or fady or what, or misty or what have you. He looks that real. And they always say that he's innocently tending to the garden. Maybe he was executed here. Maybe he was one of the 9 people that died there. Or maybe he was just another inmate. Who knows? Be interesting to see what this man's identity is, right? You can come and visit the old Idaho State Pen today. Hit up the Idaho's Historical Society page online and join in a haunted fun time. History.idaho.gov. From what I saw during the winter months, they are open Monday through Sunday from noon to 5 p.m. Summer, beginning Memorial Day through Labor Day, they are open Monday through Sunday, 10 a.m. and closing at 5 p.m. You can also call them at 208-334-2844. So, I was curious to see the prices, and it makes you kind of put in a date, so I don't know if depending on the date the prices change, but I just happened to pick a random date in April, and it showed that for museum admission for an adult, it is $10. And to check out the old Idaho State Pen, what we just talked about today, adults is $8, and children are cheaper, and they do offer military discounts for our phenomenal vets. And I have to say, I just absolutely adore locations like this, where you can go, they welcome you, and you just get to learn so much. I just always kind of try to envision how it was back then at these places, and I love hearing about the history and the haunts, of course. So if you're in the Boise, Idaho area, or just in Idaho in general, or you're planning on making a trip out that way, please definitely put Old Idaho State Penitentiary in your itinerary. You won't be disappointed. A big, huge thanks, everybody, for stopping by. It is absolutely appreciated. Did you enjoy this week's episode? Listen to the others. They're all phenomenal. Haven't heard every single damn one yet? No need to fret, my friends. You could hit up any of those amazing podcast platforms, such as Spotify, Google Chrome, Blueberry, Pocket Casts. Basically, wherever you may roam to hear your other spooky podcasts, you'll probably find Paranormal Prowlers podcast lurking in the background. Thanks, everybody. Have a great week, and
I will see you next week.